Hello, and welcome to History Extra on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our first story will be quite familiar to those of us living in the Valley of the Sun. When Britain felt the heat, in 1976, the UK was plunged into the worst heat wave it had experienced for decades. 50 years on, Eugene Byrne recalls a summer in which Britons shared baths, tempers frayed, and ladybirds took to the skies in their billions. Sun worshippers. Brighton Beach, June 1976. The mythical status of that year seemed to grow with every heat wave, writes Eugene Byrne. You hear older people saying things like, "It's not as hot as it was back then." Brenda, a suburban housewife, returned home to Birmingham with her family in late August 1976. After a holiday in Devon, she now surveyed the fortnight's worth of grubby clothes produced by herself, her husband, their daughter, and three sons. How would she cope with this mountain of washing? The nation was in a grip of unprecedented water shortage, and Brenda had to set an example. She told the reporter from the Birmingham Mail that baths were no longer permitted. The family were only allowed very quick showers. The water from these was collected and left in the bath for soaking dirty clothes with a small amount of detergent. Perhaps they wouldn't pass the what-do-you-call-it test, blue whiteness or something, she said, half recalling the TV adverts for Day's washing powder. But they are clean enough for the situation now. Her husband, she said, already twisted a wire coat hanger around the bollock in the toilet cistern, meaning it wouldn't fill up all the way, and thought that the shower water the clothes were soaking in could next be used in the washing machine. We are well washed in this household, all right, she joked, brainwashed into saving every drop. Brenda's husband was a very motivated water conserver. On one of the last days of their holiday, the family had been setting off for the beach when the owner of their hotel rushed out to tell him he had an important phone call. Number 10 Downing Street was on the line, said the proprietor, half apologetically, thinking it might be a prank. It wasn't. Prime Minister James Callaghan was phoning to tell Brenda Howell's husband, Dennis, that he was now the minister responsible for tackling the drought. Hellishly hot. The long, hot, very dry summer of 1976 occupies a particular place in British popular memory. Britons were accustomed to the occasional summer heat wave, but normally they only went on for a few days and usually ended with thunderstorms. This was very different, with sustained periods of hot weather, sometimes cloudy but usually sunny, and very little rain until the heavens finally opened at the end of August. For those in heavy manual jobs or working in bakeries or kitchens, it was often hellish, while office workers in those pre-air-conditioned times suffered too. A man in most white-collar jobs in the 1970s was expected to wear a suit and tie, and many were now given a wide berth by female colleagues because in hot weather, the smell of a man in a nylon shirt that hadn't been washed for a day or two was far from pleasant. The women knew well enough to go without tights and wear cotton instead of man-made fibers. Chris Tinsley, who had started work just after finishing his A-levels, remembers, "A sweltering old building. It was hot, very hot, and our only relief from the heat was being allowed by the manager to work with our ties off. We spent much of the day killing flies with elastic bands. We made our own entertainment in those days." Britain had not seen a summer like this since 1911, though now we might see it as the harbinger of a new normal. We have had many more hot summers since, and the highest temperature recorded in the UK in 1976, 35.9 degrees on July 3rd, has been exceeded numerous times in later years, with the record at the time of this writing as 40.3 degrees set at Coningsby in Lincolnshire in 2022. Yet the mythical status of 1976 seems to grow with every new heat wave. You hear older people saying things like, "It's not as hot as it was back then," or "We survived it." Some of this may be the boomer generation fondly recalling carefree youth, a time when your only responsibilities were a paper round or keeping a school friend's secret as to who they had a crush on. Teenage girls read their copies of Jackie magazine in the back garden while trying to get a suntan, and then perhaps suffering sleepless nights caused by a sunburn instead. Lads hung out at a local Lido with mates because it was just too hot to play football in the park. Even those in work had the leisure time to lounge around, listening to Radio 1 on the transistor radio as it belted out songs like The Combined Harvester or Elton John and Kiki D's with Don't Go Breaking My Heart. In the evenings, pubgoers would even stand out on the pavement. Drinking al fresco had simply not been the done thing in Britain. Clive Lloyd's West Indies cricket team was touring Britain, thrilling supporters with their aggressive bowling, and Viv's Richards batting. The test matches were covered extensively on TV, which could be watched in the relative cool of a darkened room. Rise in excess deaths. But looked on with a colder eye, 1976 was a troubled time, and some people didn't survive because the heat caused a 20%, according to one study done in Birmingham, increase in excess deaths. Hospital admissions rose, crop yields fell, food prices went up, and the country almost ran out of water. Earlier that year, Labor Prime Minister Harold Wilson had stepped down to be succeeded by James Callaghan, who inherited huge problems. Inflation was falling from its post-war high of 24% the previous year, but a powerful trade union movement was still demanding pay rises to maintain their members' living standards. Unemployment exceeded 1 million, a figure that would have satisfied many later governments, but which in the 70s appalled people who only 10 years previously could quit a job they didn't like and walk into a new one the same day. There was a near civil war going on in Northern Ireland, with bombings, assassinations, and sectarian murders by loyalist and Republican terrorists. The Provisional IRA frequently bombed mainland Britain, too. This was a year that saw frustrations over police attitudes to minorities boil over into a riot at the Notting Hill Carnival at the end of August. Meanwhile, The Clash, The Buzzcocks, and The Sex Pistols were all making a splash that summer, heralding the onset of punk and new wave and more confrontational and angry youth culture. Open your local or regional newspaper from the 1970s and you'll be struck by the shocking levels of violence, reports of pointless street thuggery, racist attacks, and of course, football hooliganism. All-pervading stink. And then there were all the stories of road accidents. There were 6,570 reported fatalities on Britain's roads in 1976, compared to fewer than 1,600 in 2025. By further comparison, about 3,600 people died in the whole of Northern Ireland, troubles between 1969 and 1998. Despite what some older people might claim on social media, this was not necessarily a better time. And on top of everything was the all-pervading stink of cigarette smoke, because over half of adult men and over 40% of women were addicted to tobacco. In more recent heat waves, firefighters have made plain their loathing of disposable barbecues. But in the 1970s, it was often discarded cigarettes that were the problem. Being a fireman, and they were very nearly all men until the early 1980s, was one of the worst jobs to have in 1976. By July, they were struggling across the country to deal with heath fires and forest fires, often calling for assistance from the army and even borrowing tankers from the Milk Marketing Board to transport water to douse the flames. It was not unusual for some crews to work with few breaks for 72 hours or more, many collapsing from exhaustion. Some fires were worse than others. Mike Gartside, living with his parents in Rockdale, remembers the standout memory of that year was the sewage work suffering a major fire and breaking down completely, resulting in a hideous stink, which hung over our side of Rockdale for 2 to 3 weeks. Journalists consoled themselves with the best silly season ever. The local and national papers were going to have lots of pictures of young women, preferably in bikinis, on the beach, at the pool, frolicking in town center fountains, etc. Plus a side order of babies, toddlers, and dogs looking cute, even wearing the traditional British sun hat made from a knotted handkerchief. The tabloids were obsessed with sex in a way that would have been considered grotesque just 10 years previously. The permissive society had arrived, though on male terms. Between them, the Daily Mirror and the Sun were selling more than 7 million copies daily and were now featuring topless models. Both papers carried articles more in hope than expectation, wondering if there would be a St. Tropez-style outbreak of topless sunbathing in Margate. Spoiler, there wasn't. Perspiring Prince. As temperatures soared across Britain, the press had a field day. Reporters fried eggs on car bonnets, exposed profiteering, and above scrutinized Prince Charles's every effort to stay cool. Cub reporters were dispatched to fry eggs on pavements or car bonnets and to find tales of profiteering, such as ice cream vans giving short measure. One found a stall holder in Hyde Park selling cans of cold Pepsi for a shocking 40 pence instead of the usual 14 pence. Inappropriate hanging. Then there were the rain dances. In the 1970s, everyone had grown up watching Western movies and TV shows. Some who had played cowboys and Indians as children carried it on into adulthood, cosplaying, although they didn't call it that back then, the Wild West, turning up in costume to give demonstrations and shows at carnivals and other events, though not always in good taste. A Bristol vicar had to tell his local Wild West reenactors that it wasn't appropriate for them to hold a public hanging at his church fete. Those opting to be Native American could go to great lengths and expense to research and faithfully recreate the lives of Plain Indians. A Wild West weekend at the American Museum in Bath featuring Bill Mickenburg of South End performing a rain dance, which resulted in a slight drizzle. "It's the first time it's ever happened for me," he told reporters. "Either it's a coincidence or my dancing is improving." Other reenactors were unsuccessful, while a man who knew nothing of Native American culture turned up as a Red Indian at a fancy dress contest in Yorkshire and improvised his own rain dance. It started bucketing down and he got soaked, but he did win first prize, a hairdryer. It was left to the inside pages of the upmarket papers to wonder what was happening to the climate. The summer of 1975 had not been as hot. However, it had been hot and dry enough, so people had been urged to conserve water. The slogan, "Save water, bathe with a friend," that everyone associates with 1976 was actually coined the previous year, though in 1976, it was on many more t-shirts. The autumn and winter had been unusually dry, too. Reservoirs in England and Wales were alarmingly low, and by January 1976, farmers and water authorities were already worried. Strange as it may seem, many experts in the 1970s thought the climate was not warming, but cooling. A widely held view was that we were facing a new ice age, based on the fact that the mean annual temperatures in the Northern Hemisphere had been falling since the 1940s. Speaking to the Royal Meteorological Society in April 1976, Dr. B.J. Mason, director of the Met Office, said there was a high chance that temperatures in Britain were likely to be cooler, but not glacial. The weather also produced a bizarre phenomenon that everyone would remember: huge swarms of ladybirds. The warm spring produced billions of aphids, which the ladybirds fed on, but the aphid population collapsed as plants matured and dried early, causing billions of ladybirds to swarm in search of food at locations around the country. Sally was a teenager in Somerset, seaside town, and remembers catching a bus one day. A cloud of ladybirds stormed down the prom. The driver quickly opened the doors of the bus for me to get in, and he slammed them shut behind me. The ladybirds hit the bus like something out of a Hitchcock movie. Karen Morgan, who is 15 and with her parents on a caravan holiday in, she thinks, Devon, met a boy she was sweet on at the campsite. One evening, I had this romantic notion that we should walk along the beach to watch the sunset. All along tide lines were millions of dead ladybirds, a belt of insects about a foot wide and 3 or 4 inches deep. I can't remember the boy's name, but I remember those ladybirds. Taps run dry. Britain did not see bright sunshine every day, but it often did. At Heathrow, there were 16 consecutive days in which the temperatures exceeded 30 degrees. By August, the government was bringing in emergency legislation because of the drought, and hosepipe bans were already in force in most of England and Wales. The worst-hit areas were South Wales and parts of southwest England. Water supplies were actually turned off for several hours each day in South Wales, while standpipes were erected in parts of the country by local water authorities, though they were only used extensively in North Devon. Standpipes were the nuclear option. All domestic water supplies would be cut off, leaving people to collect water from pipes in the streets. Sales of plastic buckets soared, and older people who had grown up without taps in their homes sagely informed everyone that fetching pails of water was hard work. It was a foolproof way of cutting water consumption drastically. When the MP for Birmingham's Small Heath, Dennis Howell, was appointed Minister for Drought in late August, parts of the country had just 35 days' water supply remaining. History has reduced Howell to a humorous footnote or pub quiz question. No, the rain did not come in torrents as soon as he was appointed. No, he did not show journalists the bath he shared with his wife. And no, James Callaghan did not order him to do a rain dance. Howell was a plain-speaking, good-humored man who was on top of his brief. At the time, everyone knew him as Minister for Sport. He was a qualified football referee, but unexpectedly, perhaps, in 1976, that role was within the Environment Department with responsibility for the water industry. He had helped draft the emergency legislation, and now he and his officials set to work. Pipelines were to be laid, rivers dammed or diverted, and tankers hired. In his memoir, Made in Birmingham, Howell says he was 10 days into the job before it really started to rain, though when it did, he was in the middle of a photo call in which he was demonstrating a standpipe on a Yorkshire housing estate. One downpour was not, he said, going to solve the water shortage, and the threat of standpipes and rationing did not recede until October. In the meantime, heavy rain on dry ground caused deluges, and so he was also the minister for floods. He embellished his legend some years later on a visit to the Soviet Union. Arriving at Tashkent in Uzbekistan, he was told the place had had barely any rainfall in 2 years. A group of British tourists recognized him and asked him if he had come to work his magic there. He did. There was a massive thunderstorm that very night. Eugene Byrne is a freelance writer and journalist. His books include Isambard Kingdom Brunel, The Engineering Visionary, published by the History Press 2025. You're listening to History Extra on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our next article is Why You Haven't Seen It All Before. It's human nature to believe that history repeats itself, but attempts to draw parallels with the past can be misguided and even dangerous, by Robert Blackmore. Across the early months of 1990, Margaret Thatcher's controversial community charge, nicknamed the poll tax, triggered an explosion of opposition, one with echoes of the past. Reenacting a 1381 revolt, reported the Kentish Gazette in March that year, anti-poll tax protesters going on a 3-day march to London later this month. For the paper and many other commentators, the protests were a direct repeat of the Peasants' Revolt, itself in part the result of an unpopular poll tax more than 600 years earlier. Both expressions of public rage brought violence to the capital. The implication was clear, that the English then and British now would never stand for an unfair tax, and that, as philosopher George Santayana wrote in 1905, Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. The question of whether history repeats itself has generated countless observations, like George Santayana's. The novelist and wit Mark Twain is often misquoted as saying, "History may not repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes." A great many have offered instead, "But historians repeat each other." Yet for some, perhaps it's all just a little bit of history repeating, as Shirley Bassey sang in her 1997 collaboration with electronic music duo Propellerheads. The Australian historian of ideas G.W. Trumpf argued in 1979 that the concept of historical recurrence was instrumental in the development of how history was written in the West. This repetition, Trumpf noted, includes such notions as retribution, rebirth, reenactment, and even imitation. There have been many, from practitioners of ancient religions to modern social scientists, who have seen systemic cycles as key structures to understand our world. Meanwhile, a preoccupation with repetition persists today, both with popular history, to make historical subjects appear relevant, and in academic history, where timelessness is necessary to secure research funding. Why then does it appear to us that history repeats? What does it tell us about what history is and what it is for? Can understanding this phenomenon help us better inform our view of the past? After all, it is not simply a matter of whether it is useful or entertaining to compare across the ages. This concerns our very relationship with continuity and change. For if history repeats, as the biblical author of Ecclesiastes put it, what has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. The highly intricate Maya calendar was based on astronomical cycles. The course of political history is presented as particularly replete with repetition in the formation, organization, and decay of states. It is worth offering a few examples Trumpf highlighted, such as in China. Cycles are also an essential part of Chinese historical tradition. In the dynastic cycle, each successive imperial dynasty would unite China after a period of disorder, their rule legitimized by a mandate of heaven. After a period of peace and prosperity, each would become increasingly ineffectual and corrupt while beset by war and natural disaster until the state disintegrated into another period of turmoil. Mesoamerican civilizations, meanwhile, such as the Olmec and Maya, famously developed intricate calendars based on astronomical cycles. This is obviously cyclical time, American historian Calvin Martin observed in 1992, connoting cyclical history. The message of the cycle, he added, was always of doom. In Europe and North America today, there is a borderline obsession with the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. Similarities to its beginning among the ruins of the Roman Republic in the first century BC are seen to have recurred again and again, from Napoleon Bonaparte's supplanting of the first French Republic in 1799 with the coup of 18 Brumaire, to Adolf Hitler's dismantling of the Weimar Republic in 1933-34. Advocates of liberal democracies frequently express fears that a latter-day Julius Caesar, equivalent to the Roman populist dictator, will emerge in their midst. Parallels with the Roman Empire's fall in the West in the 5th century AD are likewise used everywhere, especially by critics of the European Union. In 2021, Boris Johnson, then British Prime Minister, claimed that the empire fell largely as a result of uncontrolled immigration, and Europe went into a dark ages that lasted a very long time. The point is that it can happen again. This is a problematic comparison, and considering that in 1984, the German historian Alexander Dumont collated no fewer than 210 different explanations for the fall of Rome. Incredibly simplistic. Besides, everything will fall apart if you wait long enough. Such evaluations are undoubtedly made for political reasons and are clearly used in the George Santayana fashion to warn against repeating mistakes. In other words, the need for lessons is reason enough to seek comparisons. A similar approach could work when considering individuals. In his parallel lives, the ancient Greek biographer Plutarch deliberately set out key figures from history in pairs, one Greek and one Roman, to reveal their common virtues and behaviors. Plutarch's approach offers us one possible explanation for why history appears to repeat itself, that it is inseparable from the very practice of writing history. That historians repeat each other is indisputable. One only need to scan a bookshop's shelves or any work's bibliographic references to sense the great tangled web of duplication that scholarship weaves. This has a long history. Ancient writers would frequently mimic the structure, themes, and narratives from previous works they admired, or even incorporated whole passages. Medieval chroniclers would likewise often reuse, sometimes almost verbatim, episodes from ancient histories. The 11th century Norman chronicler William of Poitiers even lifted Julius Caesar's famous saying, "Vendi, vidi, vici," I came, I saw, I conquered, from the work of Roman historians and had his patron William the Conqueror say it instead. Just as writers imitate and emulate, it is evidently normal for us to seek patterns in the past, to pick out ideas, concepts, and behaviors that seem similar to us. This seems to be how our minds work. To make personal connection across time is an act of empathy, and that is a very human trait. Today, many have drawn parallels between the Russo-Ukrainian War and the First World War, mainly for their trench warfare, frontal attacks by waves of soldiers on fortified positions, and artillery duels. Unsurprisingly, man-made climate change is a major preoccupation today, and so is the study of environmental history, which it has expanded. The knowledge gained by our vulnerabilities within our own degraded ecosystems has made us cognizant of how past societies might have been likewise unsustainable. Similarly, the COVID pandemic that hit the world from 2020 immediately prompted comparisons, some implicit and explicit, with the Black Death. I myself was guilty of this, but the differences were in fact stark. The latter was spectacularly more deadly. We now think mortality from plague impacted between a third and half of the population, perhaps even more. Some might point to the near absence of a modern scientific culture in the Middle Ages and compare this to misinformation and pseudoscience that circulated during COVID. But that is not a fair assessment. Medieval societies framed their suffering in their own terms. We should not expect them to have done otherwise. Twain never said history sometimes rhymes. The first attribution of this to him was, by all accounts, as recent as 1970, 6 decades after his death. However, Twain did write, with his co-author, Charles Dudley Warner, in The Gilded Age, A Tale of Today, that history never repeats itself, but the kaleidoscope combinations of the pictured present often seem to be constructed out of the broken fragments of the antique legends. While less succinct, this seems to be altogether a better assessment. Many aspects of today offer muddled reflections of times gone by. Yet ultimately, the times themselves, as Ovid would say, nova sunt semper, that is, they are always new. Dr. Robert Blackmore is a historian and a visiting academic at the University of Southampton. You've been listening to History Extra on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is Royal Classical British Music by D'Lo Sound. Remember, you can always catch a program you've missed on sunsounds.org. Please join us next time for an upcoming episode.